Before we begin, just giving you an update on our new subscription. It's called David McWilliams Plus on Apple. You just double click, you get no ads, and you get me and John, pure and simple.
And Mac, you get early access to episodes. Did you know that?
Sure, my day is made.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by ACAST.
How are you doing there? It is podcast time. We've got a really special one. It's a conversation I had with Fintan O'Toole, you know, maybe Ireland's premier public intellectual, at the Dalkey Book Festival on his book, We Don't Know Ourselves, Personal History of Ireland Since 1958. If you haven't read it, go out and get it. It's an extraordinary piece of work, of journalism, of political analysis, of economic analysis, of sociological, of literary weight. It's great. And Fintan's one of the good guys. And here's the chat, myself and Fintan O'Toole. So Fintan, I said we're going to do the six events. It's probably the easiest way. By the way, the book is extraordinary. It's fantastic. There are gems in the story. I love the bloom being buried halfway between the cemetery and your estate. It's really, really. I mean, it's full of gems. Let's get right into it. Right, we've got an hour. Let's get right into it. We're going to start. We're going to kick off with the first one. You say is late '50s, 58. The year we start, T.K. Whitaker.
Yeah.
Let's go.
So there are two huge events in 1958. One is my birth, obviously, and then the other one. The really key moment, really, that sets off the whole story of the transformation of Ireland over the course of my lifetime and many of your lifetimes is this extraordinary civil servant called T.K. Whitaker, whom everybody knows about, you know. But Whitaker saw a cover of, there was a satirical magazine called Dublin Opinion. And it had a cartoon which kind of set a map of Ireland saying, like, property for sale, owners leaving, you know. And he just thought, something has to be done here. Whitaker, you have to remember, was a Catholic from Northern Ireland. He was an Irish speaker. He was, in many ways, a kind of conservative nationalist.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't a natural revolutionary. 1958 was also the year where one of my favorite novels was published, which is Giuseppe de Lampedusa's The Leopard, that great Italian novel. And it has that fantastic line in it. It's set during the Italian Revolution, you know, and the Duke is a central character, and his nephew, whom he loves, is going off to join the revolutionaries. And he says, how can you do this? You're betraying the king. You're betraying everything we stand for. And the young fellow says, you don't understand. In order for things to stay the same, things have to change. Yeah. And that was Whitaker, you know, that in order to keep a sense of the Ireland, which, remember, is still a very raw, young state, but it could not continue to survive as an independent entity with the protectionist policies that had defined it. And so Whitaker publishes a document called Economic Development. Can you think of a more boring title?
And I've done it loads of times. Don't worry.
It's a grey book. And fascinatingly, it's published under his own name, by the Department of Finance. So, and the reason for this, and this was his courage. He's a young guy, you know, he's a genius. He's got, you know, top of the civil service tree, but he publishes it under his own name. Why? Because if the government, if there's a bad reaction, the government say, it's that fellow Whittaker.
No, this was never
an official document. This was never. It just goes through very patiently the state of the economy. You know, that's a really shocking document to read.
Yeah.
Because you think things like cheese, you know, like, okay, it's an agricultural economy, fine. Right.
Yeah.
Huge dairy herds. How much cheese do we export? 35,000 pounds worth of cheese.
So it's got through all the details.
It's like, you know, it's just like we can't even make goddamn cheese.
Yeah.
You know,
we export.
And I don't know if some of you of my age will remember how appalling Irish cheese was in our childhood. Remember that?
Look at the heads nodding. Poor Alan. You know,
do you remember the orange stuff that tasted like soap? I mean, that was.
Yeah.
And you look at now, I mean, cheese would be a very interesting way of thinking about the transformation of Ireland, how wonderful it is. But anyway, so it was Whittaker's. And Whittaker basically just says, the game is up, folks.
Yeah.
You know, and we have to open up this economy. And it's a really interesting moment where he says, they set the target for economic growth at 2%.
Modest.
Well, he knew that, he said, you just do a few simple things, you're going to get more than 2%.
Yeah.
Because, like, you're growing from such a low base.
Yeah.
The base is so low that if you look at the table of Irish exports and Irish imports in those years, in the first five exports is horses.
Wow.
And in the first five imports is horses. And it's the same horses going to horse races in England.
Coming back.
That's how small the economy is. Horses going to Aintree and coming back feature as major imports and exports, you know.
Yeah.
So you can get growth really pretty easily just by doing a few sensible things. But he knew they would exceed the 2%. But his point was, we're so depressed that you have to set a target that you will exceed. So it was the opposite of Stalinism. Stalinism was like, this was like, set a really low target because then people will feel good about getting
you're
over it.
Stalinism. No, but it's interesting, you forget, the 1950s, 500,000 people emigrated in the 1950s alone to Britain.
To Britain.
To Britain, not anywhere else. Yeah. To Britain, to 500,000 people. And my dad used to tell me around here, around Dalkey, Dunleary, that the salaries from the RAF kept the place going. So the RAF had big production facilities after the war in the West Midlands.
Yeah.
And he said particularly what was always noticeable during the Easter Lily, at Easter Sunday, that the most of the Easter Lilies were bought with wages that were actually from the RAF.
Wow.
Which is kind of ironic at the time. But so the country was actually imploding.
I mean, it really was. And exactly as you say, David, like this is not an abstract thing, right?
It's demographic.
By the end of the 1950s, there are fewer than 3 million people left in the 26 counties, you know. And it's the young people leaving after the war. I listed in the book, I just found my father's address book, you know, and it's all his siblings, you know, and it's Birmingham, it's different parts of London, it's, you know, Coventry. His sister, he has just somewhere in Australia. I think it's like very sad, isn't it? You know, but there's nobody left except him. And the only reason he didn't emigrate, he'd gone to get the papers for Canada. He had an uncle in Canada. He was going off to Canada. And my mother agreed to marry him. And he didn't know his look. Like, she was way out of his league, you know, in terms of looks. And, you know, she was beautiful, actually, my mother was, you know. But it's interesting what you're saying about the army. Again, it's just these little details, you know. The reason my mother agreed to dance with him, they met in the Metropole, you know, they would watch, she told me this, that the girls would watch the fellas coming in and you'd look at their suit, you know, you'd look at their gloves, because she said every fella would have one good suit.
Yeah.
That wouldn't tell you an awful lot, you know, because they'd go to everybody would go to a tailor at some point and they could wear the suit to the dance. But it was the gloves, she said, that a nice pair of gloves would make the fellow interesting. And my father had a pair of British Army driver's gloves that his older brother had given him from the Second World War, which I think had been worn at the Battle of El Alamein.
Impressive.
They were sort of leather with kind of mesh, you know, and they looked expensive.
And he was the man.
You know?
He was the man.
So it was the Battle of El Alamein that made my parents meet. But, you know, this massive, and the depression it created, you know, There's a fantastic line in a Tom Murphy play from that time, you know, very bitter play called Whistle in the Dark, set in Coventry, of course, you know. And one of them says, and excuse the language, but one of the guys says, the economy of Ireland is fucked since the demand for St. Patrick's Day badges dried up. It's that sense of like,
yeah,
it's you know, there's nothing, you know, and so, and also it was a bloody awful place. I mean, I'm sorry, you know, there's been a lot of revisionism since, but the 50s were fantastic. If you had a lot of money in this place, it was fantastic because property was really cheap. Servants were very, and people had, you know, people working their help, you know, but for the most people, it was terrible. And, you know, this the repression, you know. So the weekend I was born, in February 1958, the Dublin Theatre Festival was cancelled. Why was it cancelled? Because John Charles McQuaid, whom we will come on to talk about, who was the kind of moral ruler of Ireland, the Archbishop of Dublin, had indicated his displeasure that there were works by James Joyce and Sean O'Casey going to be in the thing. He didn't make a speech or give a sermon. He just kind of, I don't know, he raised his eyebrow or something.
Well, yeah.
And they immediately cancelled the entire festival.
It's extraordinary,
you know. And they didn't, they were a laughingstock around the world, you know. But that was okay because we were the purest Catholic nation.
Yeah, the best.
That was the compensation. Version. That was the compensation.
And yet you have this guy Whittaker. I'll tell you, Roddy Doyle told me a great story about Whittaker, which I think is a gem. And it describes the type of person he must have been. The fact that he died at 100, not that long ago.
Yeah.
That Roddy Doyle, I think, is from Kilbarrack.
Yeah.
And there was a shop. So they're a housing estate, and you know the housing estate's built in the 50s, there'll be a housing estate, and then there'll be like a shop, there'll be a hairdresser, and there'll be a shop and whatever in the estate. And every summer, the people who ran the shop, who were called the Hickeys, went on their holidays to Arklow. And a man came in to run the shop in Kilbarrack in the 50s, and he was a gentleman called T.K. Whittaker. He was their cousin. So think about this. The chief economist of the country was running... Right? The local spar, right?
Wow. God.
For 2 weeks every summer to give the cousin a dig out.
Incredible.
But it shows you he was in tune with the people. He could see what was going on.
And if you read Economic Development, I said it's kind of depressing in some ways, but it's brilliantly written. It's written in language that everybody can understand.
Yeah.
You know, and he says in it, you know, it has language like saying, the talk of every village in Ireland is emigration. You know, it's that sort of tone that's in it. You know, we know what people are talking about. We know what people are feeling. But isn't it fascinating that none of the politicians could manage that tone? Why? Because, I mean, this place was still run by the elites which had emerged from the 1916
rising. The revolutionaries. Yeah.
You know, the person who supported Whittaker and made Whittaker possible was Sean Lamass.
Yeah.
And Lamass deserves incredible credit too, you know. But Lamass had been in the 1916 rising. He's the young whippersnapper in 1958 who's kind of coming along. Eventually, De Valera is going to go, and Lamass is the one who's going to come behind him. And it was Lamass who basically said to Whittaker, "I've got your back."
Yeah.
But nonetheless,
he's still
it's
on
not
his own.
Lamass. Who's, and he's still, yeah. But it's not Lamass who's going out and saying these things because he's still worried about, you know, this might go badly. It's the civil servants.
Well, it's funny about the civil servants. Years ago, when I worked in the central bank, I'd be writing briefs for the governor, and there was an awful expression that you knew would torpedo your career. And it wasn't that was good or bad or indifferent or appalling when you'd write the thing. You cut back on the side, would be the worst thing was unwise.
Unwise.
And if you had written something unfucking wise, right? And seriously, and unwise meant that you in the civil service, there was two types of people. There was people with horns and people with halos. And if you developed horns because you'd written something at the age of 23 that was unwise, you were gone.
Yeah.
You had to. Yeah. So Whittaker's, my point is, he's coming from that culture.
Yeah.
And he's trying to see an Ireland that is a different version of itself.
Yeah.
Okay.
And what he thinks is, you know, that, and of course, this is in a way the story of the book I'm trying to kind of tell us, which is, in a way, the one thing he's wrong about, right, is that he thinks you can have all this economic change and still have kind of conservative Catholic Ireland.
Yes.
Now, he's right for a very, very long time. You know, like in a way, you could say what's extraordinary is not that it all changes, but that just how long it takes, actually. You know, that that arguably the rest of the 20th century, so, you know, you get 42 years, arguably, out of it, out of this extraordinary change. I tried to interview him before he died, around the time of the austerity stuff, you know, and talk about unwise. He was a very gracious man, and he was a lovely man to talk to, but he said... I asked him about the austerity and bailing out the banks. And I said, well, you know, would you do an interview with that? And he said, well, I would have very interesting things to say about it, but I think it would be unwise. He said,
unwise, I'm telling you. So it wasn't just me.
He had a sense of propriety. He didn't want to, you know, he thought, well, of course he knew what I'd be up to, you know. This, you know, you'd be using it to get against the government.
But that's one of the fascinating themes in the book, is this duality, this doublespeak, right? So on the one hand, it's funny when you lay it out in the book, because lots of us forget that much of our certainly teenage lives and adult lives, early lives, was inhabiting this double world, you know, this world of moral compromise, of kind of whatever you do, say nothing. You're aware this is kind of nonsense, but clearly it is the dominant perception. You might be unwise to go out and suggest it. So we move from the 50s and Whittaker, and of course the birth in February of 1958. And then there's a lovely little passage about McQuaid.
So I mentioned John Charles McQuaid, and people probably know, he'd been involved in writing the Constitution in 1937. He was the undisputed ruler of Catholic Ireland. He was this small man, very beautiful eyes. I remember these kind of dark blue, brown eyes. I always think of him in terms of he had a telescope. So he had this beautiful mansion in Killiney, which is up for sale now, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he had his telescope, which the rumor was that it was used for spying on courting couples. and he had a magnifying glass. There's a letter in his a copy of a letter in his archive to Vivian de Valera, who was son of Eamon de Valera. Vivian was running the Irish Press, which was one of the main newspapers. And there's a letter from McQuaid saying, "Dear Major de Valera," he'd been in the Irish Army, "Dear Major de Valera, I was very disturbed to find that when I studied an advertisement for women's underwear in your newspaper with my magnifying glass, I could see the outline of the Mons Veneris." And so you have this guy who's like, you know, but he's the all-seeing eye, you know, of
that's
that
extraordinary.
Ireland.
And that's extraordinary. I'm trying to get my head around that.
I mean, I tell the other story. I mean, you know, you could go on with McQuaid stories, but, you know, there was hospitals requests was the sort of most innocent program on the radio. You know, people would, you know, ring in for, you know, Johnny's having his appendix out. Would you play?
Would you play? Yeah, yeah. You know, a request for the appendix.
Play a waltz. Yeah. You know? But somebody requested the Cole Porter song, "Always True to You, Darling in My Fashion." You know? And, you know, the phone goes from the palace, and it was always "the palace is on." Even the use of the word "palace," you know, it just kind of replaced monarchy.
Yeah,
the palace is on, saying His Grace would like to make it clear that that song is not to be played again. "True to You in My Fashion," you know, this is encouraging sexual immorality.
No,
you know, and so the next time there was a request, they played the instrumental version. I mean, and this is all absolutely true. So anyway, so McQuaid had this kind of extraordinary monarchical presence, really. And so the parish priest died. I was 10, this would be 68, and the parish priest dies. I'm growing up in Crumlin, which, you know, was a kind of corporation housing estate, which was kind of the wilds then. It's hard to think of now. Like, it's 3 miles from the GPO, probably, you know. But it was regarded as, like,
out there.
A savage place out there, you know. And the PP died, and he had been a friend of McQuaid's, and they'd been at Manu together or something, anyway. And so there was to be a solemn requiem Latin mass, which, by the way, was magnificent. I mean, I remember getting white gloves. You know,
the gloves
appeared from nowhere that we were to use for, and the candle. But anyway, I'm walking up in the morning to, you know, prepare for this theatrical event. And, I mean, I swear this is true, but so I'm just walking up the road. There's this huge Hillman Hunter, which was McQuaid's car. parked outside the parish priest's house. And I'm walking up the road, and it's very early in the morning. It's like 7 o'clock. It's like nobody was up at 7 o'clock in Ireland then.
Yeah, exactly.
But so there's 2 feet sticking out of the side of the car like this. And the chauffeur is kneeling on the footpath, polishing the shoes. And as I'm coming up, I think, oh, it's just the shoes are there. Why is he kneeling there? And then I realized, no, the archbishop's, or his feet are in the shoes. He's sitting in his car like this, with his, and he's having his shoes polished, but the guy kneeling on the pavement. You know? I mean, I was 10, and even then I thought, is that what Jesus did? That just didn't feel quite...
Doesn't look like Mary Magdalene
really,
to me.
You know. And, you know, but nevertheless, I remember putting that aside, and, you know, because the mass was so impressive, and then he came back into the sacristy, you know, and he talked to us, you know. And I'm sure the only equivalent is like being in a medieval, being a medieval peasant, you know, and the king has come, you know. Because it had that both power and sanctity, you know. And I'd never before or since felt this, I'm completely known and enclosed in this world and how wonderful it is. And, you know, he's felt such a sense of sanctity. And I suppose I look back and I think, you know, that was, of course, the power the church had. You know, it was a spiritual power as well. But and now looking back, I know at that time, so just before that, so the church was very close to the Children's Hospital in Crumlin. The chaplain, Catholic chaplain in Crumlin was a guy called Paul McGuinness. And
not the manager of U2.
Not the manager of U2. McGuinness, I should make GENNIS, McGuinness. Be interesting, wouldn't it?
I was about to say, when you said McGuinness.
Absolutely discovered a rock band.
Exactly.
It didn't happen. But McGuinness had, so Scotland Yard had got a roll of film which had been sent to a processor in London with this guy's name on it. It was the photograph of genitals of little girls from the hospital in Crumlin, right? And, you know, it just tells you the way Ireland worked, right? So Scotland Yard think, oh, right, there's a child abuser.
Yeah.
We have evidence here. Yes. His name is on the phone. I mean, you know, please return.
So we have the full Monty
Father
here.
Paul McGuinness, you know? So what happens, no, that the Scotland Yard get on to the commissioner of the Garda Síochána. The commissioner of the Garda Síochána goes straight to McQuaid with the film and says, I'm terribly sorry, you know, your grace. I'm really sorry as a racist, but like, would you deal with this?
Wow.
And gives him the film. And you know, again, so McQuaid kept very good records and he has, you know, written down, he writes down all this, you know, and how he's, you know, the commissioner behaved properly. And he had called in McGuinness, and McGuinness told him that he was just very curious. He didn't, you know, he'd grown up with brothers and he didn't know about any of this. And that he told him that this was perfectly fine. It was understandable. And he was going to get a good Catholic doctor to talk to him and explain to him about genitalia and sex and stuff. And McGuinness went on abusing children in
all through the 70s.
And then he was replaced by a guy called Ivan Payne. Who you may have heard, you know. So the hospital, like just 10 minutes from the church, like it was a major center of child abuse. And McQuaid knew about McGuinness, he knew about Payne, he knew it was a
the
priest,
amazing thing is he recorded this, he wrote it all down.
He wrote it all down, you know,
as if he just would be forever untouchable.
Yeah, completely.
That's
exactly.
And so we're talking the late 70s, they're still feeling they're untouchable.
And quite rightly feeling they're untouchable, because that's what happens. You know, if there's a scandal, the police go to the archbishop. They don't go to the courts. They don't, you know, they don't prosecute these guys.
And yet the country is opening up. And yet, so we have this nexus of power. It's a bit like when you read any Soviet accounts of Brezhnev.
Yeah.
Because, you know, so Brezhnev is ostensibly the all-powerful leader, and yet the people are just laughing behind his back and they're trying to figure out a new
way. Exactly.
And this is going on.
I think you put that exactly right, you know, and I think that parallel is probably very accurate, right? Which is that if you think social change is possible or big change is possible, you confront things. Mm-hmm. But if you think these people are always going to be in power And the church, after all, has been in power for like a couple of thousand years, so, you know, why not? You know, you can't imagine that it's never going to be the way it is. And they, in turn, can control the state. You know, they can put limits to what's possible, what's sayable. What you do is, well, some very brave people do confront it, you know. And, I mean, for me, the real, real heroes, you know, are those feminists, you know, in the early 1970s, you know, who went on the Late Late Show and, you know, did the contraceptive train, you know, because they were just shameless. They were shameless hussies, you know. And God, if there was ever a country that needed shameless hussies, you know, it was this place. And, you know, so there were very brave people. You can imagine David Norris going on the Late Late Show, the only homosexual in Ireland, you know. You know, it wasn't
which
amazing.
Which kind of makes homosexuality difficult.
Well, you know, it showed the church was right, because there was only one homosexual in Ireland.
Yeah,
and then once you started talking about it, they're all at it now, you know. I mean, so, you know, maybe John Charles McQuaid was absolutely right about this. But this is, I suppose, the story I'm trying to tell in this was, I suppose if you go back, like, how does it collapse so quickly? It can only collapse because it's already rotten from the inside. And so it's not that, you know, everybody's believing all of this stuff and thinks it's all great. Everybody knows about child abusing priests, everybody knows about the schools, everybody knows all this stuff, but we pretend not to know it. We dodge around it.
Yeah.
My two favorite examples of this mentality, well, the slightly more cheerful ones are the Connie Dodger. Has anybody ever heard of the Connie Dodger? I was doing an event in Ennis earlier in the year, and the stage manager said, my granny is the woman who did the Connie Dodger.
The Connie
and
Dodger?
The Connie Dodger was a unique Irish item of confectionery. Right? So the Bishop of Cork was called Cornelius Lucy. And he was a real, himself and McQuaid were like that. They were, you know, the real arch conservatives. And so he was called Connie, of course, in Cork.
Yeah.
And Connie insisted on a particularly strict interpretation of the rules for Lent, which was that you were allowed to have one meal and two collations, was the term. And a collation was like a biscuit. So this woman's granny in Cork, brilliant, the baker, invented what was called the Connie Dodger, which was a biscuit that size. And I think, you know, that's fantastic. It keeps the rules. It doesn't confront anybody, you know. Everybody is strictly behaving as they're supposed to behave. But the Connie Dodger is one of them. And the other one I absolutely love, and again, this is a heroic tribute to the women of Ireland, you know. Ireland in the 1970s had by far the highest rates of menstrual problems in the known universe. I mean, nobody had ever come across before, you know, the inability of Irish women to control their menstrual cycles. Like, I don't know what was wrong with you all, but you just couldn't. Of course, we do know what was wrong, right? Which was, so that this became a international science, was thinking, what's going on in Ireland? Is there a different moon or something? It's kind of irregular cycles. And of course, what was going on was, of course, that you could not prescribe the pill. The pill was banned, as were condoms, remember? You could, you know, condoms. But you could prescribe the pill as a cycle regulator. That was the phrase used. I thought it was something to do with the Tour de France, but no. You know, so, and again, of course, this was a certain privilege. You had to be well-connected enough to know somebody who knew somebody who knew the doctor, who would say, oh yes, your menstrual cycles were
irregular.
There's a fabulous list I found of the symptoms, you know, which was like being too fat, being too thin, being too hairy, not having enough hair. Like, you know, you could get like every single possible thing. You could say, oh, this is a menstrual problem. I think you need this pill.
I love it.
And then, of course, you also had to have a chemist, you know. But there were, I mean, chemists would question women. I mean, it would say, all right, why are you getting this? You know, is it as a cycle regulator or is it as a contraceptive? Now, the irony is, of course, that a huge number of these women are Catholic teachers and Catholic nurses. The entire Catholic system would collapse if they weren't doing this, right? Because they're married women. This had been solved, of course, which was married women lost their jobs, of course, when they got married. But we're getting liberal now. We sort of allow them to keep their jobs. You have Ireland is kind of expanding. These services are expanding. The church wants to keep control of them. So, you know, the entire system would collapse if those women were going on maternity leave every year. You know, so you have to have a system which allows everybody to pretend There's one thing happening and something else is really happening. And this is the
but this is the essence, isn't it? That at a constant level there is not just hypocrisy, but an extraordinary creative opacity.
Creative opacity is a brilliant description of it. And, you know, but it is creative.
I wouldn't have been unwise if I came up with that in 23. I would have been
fine. You know, but it is creative, you know. And, you know, this is the sort of odd thing about it, that I think it is linked to the extraordinary creativity of the culture, you know, that it's a culture which, maybe going back to colonial times, you know, has got incredibly used to, you know, if you confront power, they'll crush you.
Yeah.
So you can do two things. You can feck off, which is the main thing, you know, get out of the place. Or you can learn to live in a world where... John McGahern, the great novelist, said, I remember telling me a great story about when he went to live in Leitrim, Mohill. He lived in a really remote Leitrim. And one of the neighbours, after a few weeks, said to him, John, you're not going to Mass. And John said, No, I don't go. I said, well, why don't you go, John? And John said, well, you know, I don't believe, and I'd feel a hypocrite if I went. And he says, but you're John, none of us believe. We just go to see the other hypocrites. I mean, it's sort of brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah, it is brilliant. It is brilliant.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So in the book, we move on to another event, which is Muhammad Ali.
Yeah. I just try to tell the story in the book, but it's just a really way of trying to talk about how kind of...
Because he was the most famous man in the world, the biggest superstar ever, represents, you know, everything. He's the man, he goes to prison, he's the civil rights, he changes religion. He is the global superstar. There's never been a bigger... superstar.
Absolutely. You know, and so it's very interesting business about... So, and the story I tell is like my father adored Muhammad Ali more than he adored me or Ali. But, you know, yeah. Like he just loved... I remember, and it was very shocking. I mean, I remember hearing him use the word beautiful about a man. You know, and that was really terrible. I used to say, he's so beautiful. And my father had been a boxer. He was an Irish junior champion boxer. He loved boxing. Wow. Boxing was a big He was a tough guy, you know. He was a little man, but he was tough,
always the scariest.
Know. Yeah,
yeah.
You know, geez, you wouldn't take on my father. Geez, he was fierce. But you know, he loved boxing, the history of boxing, everything about it. And he just thought, you know, this man was just sensational. And then he also loved his stance against the Vietnam War and his courage in going to jail and, you know, all that stuff. And so Ali arrives in Dublin in 1972, and my father was a bus conductor, and he's on the bus. I think it's the Kiltearnan route, one of those, you know, ones that went up the foothills, Enniskerry, Kiltearnan. First bus out, you know.
Yeah.
And he's looking out. There's nobody really around much, you know. They would collect a few people, but they're going out. And he sees this sight, you know, which is these big black men running. Well, sir, anybody running for Sark, that's enough. Like,
that's,
that would be the most exotic event of your day anyway. And then these huge, beautiful black men running. And of course, he realizes one of them is Muhammad Ali. You know, it's Muhammad Ali and
the
his
crew.
Entourage, you know, in their white tracksuits, you know, running up the hill. And he stops the bus, you know, and
of course he does.
Of course he does, you know. And he says, you know, do you want to get on, you know? And Muhammad Ali gets on the bus, you know. And there's a few people who are half asleep, and I'm like, oh, imagine that. And they have a big, you know, and I'm out, I don't have the fare, and I didn't bring my money, my wallet with me, it's in the hotel, and they have this kind of chat, and I said, oh, for you, we'll make an exception, you know. He says, well, we'll take you up the hill. And I said, oh, no, I got to fight this big guy, you know, I better get back and running. And they have this, and, you know, my father just came home that day, I mean, the glowing, you know, like, just this encounter, you know, this idea that this had happened. But it's a fascinating little moment, because what do we do in Ireland? So it's about race and ethnicity and all those kind of things, which will become very important as the place changes. But what we do is, of course, find his Irish roots.
Of course we do.
You know,
yeah. Of course you do.
You know, like, you just, you know, we have to assimilate everything to us. We don't really just, so JFK, of course, JFK's visit in 63 had been the big kind of moment of this. But, you know, it's this thing of, and of course we did later with Obama.
Oh, yeah.
I think very uncomfortably. Like, the first black president of America was, ah, yeah, but he's really Irish, you know?
I know.
You know? Like, but we do this with Ali. And so I quote a thing in the book. I found this thing, you know, from the Clare Champion or something. But, well, of course, you know, he's one of the famous O'Gradys. you know, and they go through, like, O'Grady, who was master of the Clare Hunt. And Cornelius O'Grady, who was the Fianna Fáil parliamentary secretary to the minister for something in 1940, you know. And then there's this other, you know, Muhammad O'Grady.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's a very interesting moment because Ali is really furious. I mean, he's really angry because he's in that phase where he's changed his bloody name to get away from what he thinks of as slavery.
Yeah. You
know? He knows he has white ancestors, but he assumes that he's a product of rape. I mean, which of course is, you know, true of so many of African-American people, you know. As it happens, oddly, this wasn't true. I mean, it's actually a much more moving story. I mean, his O'Grady great-grandfather was, you know, married a free black woman in Louisiana, you know, which was unusual, or in Kentucky, rather. But he thought that this was a slave name. You know,
and that was his whole Cassius Clay. The whole Cassius Clay thing.
That's why he changed that. And when they started saying, "Oh, you're one of the O'Gradys," he thought, "You know, you're trying to
don't relabel
me." And the Irish thing is totally innocent and stupid, and you know. But then the way he handles it, he was such a brilliant man, you know. And he's asked in an RTE interview where they said, "You know, and you know the O'Gradys," and he said, he just says, let's not talk about that. He said, there was a lot of sneaking around in them days. And of course, then there was, oh, he's talking about sex. Oh, Jesus, let's not talk about that. And they just shut up, you know. And he was brilliant at just, he realizes, this is how I shut these people up.
Yeah,
I'll hint that if you want to talk about it, we might have to talk about sneaking around, you know. So
But also, I suppose, his kind of coming to Ireland is a certain moment because nobody ever came here. Like, I remember, you know, Muhammad Ali, my dad and your dad shared this obsession with boxing, and the Rumble in the Jungle happened about 2 years later. I think it was on Halloween of 1974.
Yeah.
And my dad was in the Congo, and because they needed to get it for American primetime TV at 9 o'clock in America, they fought at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
And it was the first time we were ever allowed up late after about 10 o'clock was to watch this thing. But also my dad went down to Eddie Totterdale's TV hire and rented a colour TV.
Wow.
We all, the whole road came into the McWilliams' kitchen to watch The Rumble in the Jungle on the colour TV.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the worst thing was I came back from school, national school, the next day, hoping to watch Tom and Jerry on the colour TV, and it was gone. It was given back to Totterdale's.
The tragedy of your life.
The tragedy of my life. Back into the black and white world. But the key is what you're saying is Ali arriving again is a moment.
Yeah.
Because it's a big international superstar coming here.
And it also forces us, I mean, how in an incredibly awkward, stupid way to think about what's Irish American, right? If JFK is Irish American, that's fine, but is Muhammad Ali an Irish American? And this coincides with the reason I sort of tell the story, well, apart from it being a good story itself, but of course this is also the lead up to joining the European Union, you know, where we're having to think about Irishness in this new context, you know. I remember as a kid, you know, like that. So not long before Ali came, Charles de Gaulle had suddenly resigned as the president of France. And where did he go? He goes to Sneem. He turns up in Kerry, you know, and it's just like, what is going on here? Yeah. You know. And then they thought, oh, well, it's, you know, everybody loves Ireland. What it was about, of course, was that he there was a French presidential election. He knew that if he stayed in France, he would be asked about his views or he'd have to get involved. And he looked from as far as he was concerned, the place where they won't find
him. Yeah, but nobody
the most remote place. You know. So he goes to Kerry. But in the course of this, then, he reveals that, and, you know, he's a romantic, you know, and he says, maybe I was drawn to Ireland by the fact that my great-great-grandmother was, you know, a MacArthur from County Down, you know. And so I remember his kid thinking, so Muhammad Ali's Irish and Charles de Gaulle is Irish. Like, so it means everybody can be Irish. And it's a kid's thing, but actually it's become true, isn't it, hasn't it? You know, that actually this sort of idea that it's a very capacious kind of nationality, you know, because of the history of migration.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
It actually does contain all this kind of stuff. And the fear at the time, the cultural fear at the time would be, if we sort of admit this as well, it'll all go. It'll mean nothing. So yeah. You get a kind of reaction to this, which is sort of, let's hold on to the Catholic thing, because that's our brand, you know, and the nationalist thing. And of course, you've got the troubles going on in Northern Ireland, all that stuff going on. So we sort of avoid this, but being let into the common market, and by the way, we were let in. I mean, there was no question that Ireland would have got into the common market as well at the time if Britain wasn't joining. You know, we were an adjunct.
There was no way, you think?
No way. Absolutely okay. No way. And it's such an irony now, isn't it,
yes.
That we've been left with this great legacy of Europeanness and Britain's tragically losing it, you know. But, I mean, that's completely the case. You know, we were so poor. I mean, we just didn't reach those levels. I mean, we had less than, 60%, wasn't it?
We were given back colour TVs.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
But that in itself is really an indicator.
It is, yeah.
You know, we were living in black and white.
Yeah.
But the 70s was a transformative decade.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And, well, because, I mean, joining the European Union is such an enormous force in Irish history, you know. Because what it does is, I mean, to be really blunt about it, it's the first thing that makes sense of independence. You know, independence had been an economic disaster. It had been a demographic disaster because people just kept leaving. And as you were saying, David, like, where were they going? They were going to Britain. I mean, the humiliation, you know, we leave the mother country and then we go back, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it was really terrible. Now, would most Irish people have voted to go back? No, they wouldn't. You know, the psychological importance is huge and the sense of national pride, I'm not denying any of that, but objectively, like, it's been a failure. What justifies independence and makes it a real thing is being able to join the common market. I mean, remember, we're one of only 9 countries and we are legally and you know, of the same status as Germany, you know, and in France.
At the same table. Which they made always a big deal of. We are at the table.
It's at the table. I mean, it was an incredible vindication of Irish sovereignty and Irish nationality. This is what the Brexiteers could never understand. I mean, they thought we would leave the European Union when Britain left. They genuinely did. And for them, you know, being in Europe was humiliation. You know, it was only being on the same level as France and Germany, you know, is a historic shame, you know. Whereas for us, of course, as a small country and as a very raw country, which has all sorts of, you know, problems of historic shame, and this was a huge thing. And the confidence in the 70s. So, you know, one of the things I remember vividly, though, so 70s, I'm going to UCD, which itself, of course, I suppose we could have picked another big moment, you know, which was 66. Donna O'Malley announcing, without telling the government, that we're going to have free second-level education. I say this to people abroad, and they say, surely you mean third-level education? No. No, we did not have second-level education free. One of Whittaker's big blind spots, I mean, I've immense admiration for Whittaker, fantastic man. Read Economic Development, the word does not appear, education.
Wow.
Doesn't appear. Wow. And in fact, this is one of the ironies, that he set in motion things that then required, if you're going to get foreign investment, you needed a better educated workforce, and you know.
Yeah.
But even in 66, O'Malley, who was actually a terrible loss, he drank himself to death. It's really bloody terrible. I mean, he was the real, of that sort of hockey generation, O'Malley was the one who had real vision and courage and imagination, you know. And O'Malley, again, it was emigration that got him. You know, he just started thinking about, not only are we exporting people, we're exporting them with primary education. Yeah. What kind of jobs are they?
We're exporting them to be poor.
To be poor.
Yeah.
To fill those, you know, slots in other people's economies. And he just felt a real sense of shame about that. So O'Malley ambushed his own government. I mean, he sent the word around to journalists. He said, I'm going to make a speech in Limerick or whatever on Saturday night. I think you should be there. And Sunday papers is Minister for Education announces from next year, you know, free second level education.
But they did it.
And he did it. Well, they had to do it then, you know, like they were stuck with this, like, because it was such a popular move. I mean, everybody said, fantastic, you know, this is really wonderful. But I'm very much, I mean, I'm older than you are, but, you know, my older brother would have been the first cohort of kids. We would never have gone to secondary school. I would not have probably gone to secondary school, you know.
Which is an amazing thing. Well, it's funny as well, and also the education explains a lot about as we project forward into the next decades. One of the most fascinating economic papers I've ever read was written by two sociologists from Galway, a guy called Cosgrave, and I'll get the names out. But they identify that the most successful people in Ireland are the sons and daughters of small farmers from East Galway. This is very, very specific.
Yeah.
That these are the people identifiable who have profited most from free education.
Yeah. Fantastic.
And the paper is about why the rural poor, as they were in the 60s, embraced free education. So they've always asked me, for example, around here, when we were kids, Coola, the local Ga team, was a minority sport. And Dalkey United, the football team, I was made captain of the under-13s because my dad was manager.
Oh.
And that was so pathetic, right?
That's nepotism, typical nepotism
team
in Ireland.
But people have always asked me, you know, why has Coola exploded here in this part of the world? And you can trace it back to the kids who did extremely well in secondary education were, again, from East Galway's larger, but mainly from the Western Seaboard.
Yeah.
And they became teachers in the 70s, and their kids, teachers, are the doctors and lawyers, and their grandkids are the people with the Hurleys here in Dalkey. Yeah. So there's been massive social change from education, but it's beautifully quiet, it's non-revolutionary, it's iterative, it's personal, but it's real. And it's changed the country completely.
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right about the 70s being the transformative decade for all of that, because the optimism of the 70s, I mean, I'm coming into adulthood, and because I got secondary school, then I could, you know, get to UCD, you know, get a degree. And this was unthinkable, you know. But also, I vividly remember the talk among us was we were going to be the first generation in the history of Ireland that didn't have to emigrate.
Yeah.
And we didn't. It didn't occur to us, you know, compared to every other generation, you know. And we thought it was over. It was never coming back. And so you've got this, really the 60s is happening in the 70s.
Yes, or the 80s.
And the 80s. Well, the 80s is we'll come to the 80s. That's a miserable story, I think, in a lot of ways. But the real optimism, you know. And you've got, like, Celtic rock, like Horselips. You've been to find ways of being modern and being
Irish. Harry Devlin might even be here.
Well, I hope he is, you know. But, you know, this sort of, you know, you don't have to be American, but you can have all the American stuff. Or, you know, you can blend it all together in certain sorts of ways. But then you get, and this is, I think, you know, why things don't move in a straight line, you know. So this whole story of modernity, modernizing, it's going generally very well up to 79. And in 79, you've got the great oil crash. You start getting the downsides of having joined the common market. So the first years are fantastic. Yeah. It's all subsidies. Industries were still protected. There were kind of, you know, grace periods. Really starts to hit in the late 70s because these uncompetitive Irish industries then start to close down. And so the Irish working class actually the urban working class is hit like a train hitting them, you know. Because you've got the huge inflation, mass unemployment starting. And that's then when you get this turn back towards the reactionary.
Yeah.
John Paul arrives in 79, you know. And again, this is like the charisma, you know, this extraordinary, another like Ali, you know, this extraordinary figure. I don't know if anybody remembers him, but, you know, I mean, he radiated this sort of power and majesty. You know, he was just a really charismatic person. But a real reactionary, you know. I mean, he's coming And if you variously look at his speeches, I mean, those masses he did were the biggest gathering. It's been said, I don't know whether it's true, but that the mass in Phoenix Park was the biggest public gathering in Europe since the Second World War.
Wow.
Because you have a million.
But it doesn't surprise me. It's a million.
I mean,
people.
It's hard to imagine. I mean, a million people, you know, at a gig. You know?
Exactly.
Pope's gig was. I mean, and so the whole country is swept by this thing, you know.
But it's really the end. It's not the beginning.
It's the beginning of a period of reaction.
Yeah.
Which looked at the time. I mean, if you were me at that time, this was really depressing because you thought, oh shit. You know, because you start getting the abortion issue.
Of course,
you start getting,
yeah.
Like, remember, in 85, proposition to remove the ban on divorce from the Constitution was defeated 2-1.
Two to one.
You know, it's not even like close.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and this is a complete ban on divorce in a society where marriages are breaking up and all sorts of stuff.
By the way, let's talk about your atheist marriage.
Oh yeah. So I thought this is. I'm not saying my atheist marriage was a major event in Irish life. I just want to talk about it a little bit, just to go back to this thing about doubleness, in a way, right? So I was married in '83. 40 years married next year, Jesus, you know. And we'd been living together for 4 years. You know, we were pretty out there, you know. living in sin for 4 years.
Filthy. Yeah, I can't look at you.
And Claire had got a job. She was a teacher. She got a job in a convent secondary school. So the business of the marriage, right? So well, two aspects of it. One is... she could not. I mean, you know, she had to invent a story about going to Rome to be married. You know, why was the head nun not being invited to the wedding? So we were married in Kildare Street. I think there were 40 non-religious marriages in Ireland that year. Yeah. I mean, it was a solicitor in Kildare Street. You went up the stairs and it was a lovely man, actually. But it was, you know, like Claire's mother didn't go to the wedding, for example. I mean, it was just so shocking. My mother was kind of great, but she was really upset. But she went, you know. But we had to solve the problem of you had to put the ban... If you weren't in the church, you know, the bans would be announced in the church, but if you weren't in the church, you had to do it. So, of course, we did the... Again, this is the classic doubleness in Ireland. We put an ad in Irish in the Irish press. Fiontán ó tuathail Irishor, agus clárni conal múinteoir. You know... You know, nobody would read it. That was absolutely perfectly fine. You know. In the official first language in the Devil's newspaper, nobody would read it. So the secret wedding, in a way. But there was two things fascinating about it. One is a woman's tax status was dependent on her husband, so Claire had to go back to the school with her wedding, a marriage certificate to, you know, get the stuff.
Wow.
And the secretary, the school secretary, took one look at it and just said, I don't think Sister Elizabeth needs to see this. Put it in an envelope.
Good for her.
Sent it to the department. And the sister said, oh, did you bring... Oh, sorry, I sent that off, you know.
Yeah.
And this was the kindness and, you know, so many people
are
wonderful
kindness.
At
that
sailing around things,
yeah.
Not confronting it. But the other thing is, I became, in 1983, I was already, I was arts editor, literary editor of the Sunday Tribune, I was writing, you know, all the time. Did I ever once mention, for 35 years, that I was married in a registry office? I mean, I've been writing the column in the Irish Times. I'm, you know, the most famous sort of fucking atheist, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Writing column in the Irish Times, all that. Never mentioned. Why? Because I couldn't. Why? Because... In 1984, the year after we were married, but the case had already been on from 1982, so right in the middle of our wedding, was the Eileen Flynn case. I don't know if anybody remembers that case, older people. So Eileen Flynn was a teacher in New Ross. She got pregnant. She was living with a guy called Richie Roach, who had a bar. She got pregnant. She went to the head nun in the Holy Faith school. So, you know, a similar kind of situation to Claire's. And again, very interesting, right? The head nun didn't say, you bold strap, you're fired. She said, oh, don't worry, we'll deal with this. Which is, of course, what they did. I have a brother priest in England. I'll get you over there. You'll go there, he'll get you put up for a while when you have the baby will be spirited away.
And you can come
you
back.
You will come back and you'll just tell the girls you were on a year's
retreat, a mission.
It never happened. That was the way of dealing with these things, you know.
Extraordinary.
Don't confront, don't, you know. And the problem was that Eileen Flynn said, I'm not doing that. You know, I'm not ashamed. I'm, you know, I'm in a relationship. His marriage had broken up. This is the love of my life. I intend to live with this man the rest of my life. We're having children. There was no, you know, she was a terrific teacher. All the kids loved her. We loved her. And the nun said, out, you're sacked. Right?
Wow.
And she was fired and she took the case to court. It went to the district court or the circuit court first. The circuit court ruling says, actually the judge says to her, you are very, very lucky you're not in an Islamic society because you would be stoned. And more or less saying, good enough for you. You know, this is a judge in our courts, you know. And then she appeals it to the High Court, and the High Court of Ireland says the nuns were absolutely right, absolutely justified, because she was giving
the
scandal.
High
the High Court, Declan Costello, the famous liberal from the
1960s.
Liberal Fine Gael
judge.
He
of the Just Society.
The Just Society, you know, says they're absolutely
this
right.
This is the Afghan relatively just society.
Yeah. But, you know, it was saying that, and he says, and the phrase used was, you have a lifestyle not in keeping with the Catholic ethos of the school. And he used that word lifestyle, meaning what happens outside of school is our business. So that meant every gay teacher, every teacher. And of course, it's deeply misogynistic, right? Because how do you prove that somebody is having sex? The only real way you can prove it, unless they would have set up cameras if they could, but they you know, didn't, was pregnancy, right? So it really only applied to female teachers. But that was the law of the land. And it still, by the way, is the law of the land. It's never been overturned. Now, I don't think you would get away with it now, but nonetheless, you know, that's hanging over. So I just want to talk about this kind of thing about the, you know, I'm talking about the doubleness, but we live the doubleness.
Yeah, like you yourself lived the doubleness.
I lived it myself.
You yourself lived it.
I had to be very careful in terms, you know, and I never mentioned, and it would have been an interesting thing to write about even, you know, just the thing was getting married and res jobs and all that sort of stuff, but I never mentioned it until 2012 when Claire
I'm remembering Shannon and I got married in the registry office, actually this day, it's our anniversary.
Oh,
and we got advantage in the registry office in Galway. And the registry office in Galway is in the mortuary. I swear to God, the registry office in Galway is in the mortuary of the hospital on the Dublin Road as you come in. And Shan and I got married in the registry office, and it's the most ugly building. And it's the most unprepossessing place. I mean, everything signaled, don't get married here. And don't bring your ma, right? That's the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I remember, and over the registry document, right, the big ledger, Shan's from Belfast, obviously, is a proclamation of the Republic.
Oh, yeah.
And she breaks out in a rash.
She's
like, oh, my God. But I do remember, it was very, very clear that, you know, even then, that was 1999.
Yeah.
It was not to be, everything was put in your way not to do so.
Not to
everything was put in your way not to do so. We're nearly out of time. I want to just end. We decided we'd finish on Riverdance.
Riverdance, yeah. Yeah, you know, it might seem, again, very trivial, but you know, I don't know if people remember it, but the gasp all over Ireland when Riverdance started as the interval act in the Eurovision Song Contest. Those were the years when... you know, it really mattered to Ireland that we won the Eurovision Song Contest.
Yes, I know.
you have to remember just how fragile our collective ego was, you know. And we kept winning it every year. It was like a great national event, you know. But it was getting to a point where we're like, oh shit, here we go, won the Eurovision Song Contest. What are we going to do? And Moya Doherty had this fantastic idea, you know, to let's do something with Irish dancing, you know. I mean, I remember Irish dancing, it was the most humiliating, terrible thing.
Yeah. Nothing moved from the hips down.
Nothing moved from the, you know, just the feet. I mean, actually, of course, beautiful and brilliant, but the versions of it that we got were so full of awfulness, you know, and anti-body, you know, it was the most anti-body dancing you could possibly do.
It's like, yeah, dancing without sex, you know, an Irish thing, yeah.
Exactly.
How can you dance without anything sexual?
Yeah. And then Michael Flatley goes, you know, with the flowing white,
with a Putin-esque chest,
you know, and Jean Butler with legs. She had legs, I swear to God, you know, with, and a short skirt, and they were fantastic dancers, you know, and the music was brilliant, and it was sexy. And but of course, there was something quite profound about it, which is, of course, they were both Irish Americans. You know, Jean's from upstate New York, and Flatley's from Boston. And they'd learned their Irishness in America.
Yes.
And so the whole story of the transformation really is about us dealing with America, essentially. You know, Europe and Britain are big things in it, but economically, of course, it's, you know, the multinational companies that are coming in here are American, you know, and it's us learning to be part of an American world. And you think, how did we do this without, well, I was going to say without going crazy, maybe we did go crazy in the 80s, actually. The 80s is a kind of complete collective nervous breakdown. But how do we begin to reconcile it is by realizing actually that it's not binary, you know, that actually our identity, because of mass migration, this American culture is also contains a lot of us. And so we're sort of recycling, we're bringing it back on this kind of fluidity. Because, you know, I spent that period in a lot of the late 90s, I was drama critic of the Daily News in New York, you know. So Broadway was my beat, you know, and the big statue in Broadway, like, is George M. Cohan, you know. And I always thought Cohan, he's obviously Jewish, you know.
Yeah.
He's Cohan. No,
he's Cohan
from Kerry, you know. Like, he learned his dancing. He really invented what we think of as Broadway dancing, you know. And he did it by putting together African-American dancing and Irish dancing.
Wow.
You know, he was an Irish dancer. His father was a piper, you know. It's an astonishing thing, you know. And he was one of the four Cohans. There were kids who, you know, did Irish dancing. His father played pipe. And, they, you know, there was a big Irish entertainment market, and then he learned. So, you know, it's actually very moving in a way, which is this sort of Riverdance kind of Broadwayized Irish dancing.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it had a history. It was kind of something which was coming back. And that moment, I mean, we screwed up that moment. But remember, Riverdance is coming. You have the peace process. You have this sort of beginnings of the Celtic Tiger. You know, and you know, the sense of confidence, the sense of it's suddenly okay to be Irish.
Absolutely.
The sense of liberation, it just begins to feel like all that stuff is going. Yeah. Now, it's also dark, right? So you know, not too far off that, you get States of Fear, Mary Raftery's astonishing series on the industrial schools. We start confronting the past. We start confronting the Magdalen laundries, the mother and baby homes, all, and the abuse and all. You know, so there's a dark side to this. But we're only able to confront it because maybe we've reached the point when there's enough confidence that we can do it. Now, we do screw this up, of course, you know, with you know, the Celtic Tiger going mad. But nonetheless, something has survived from all of that, you know, which is we're one of the few countries in the Western world that does not have a big anti-immigrant far-right party.
Absolutely.
And the reason we don't is because somehow we remember that actually multiple identity is us, you know, because of our history of migration, you know. This, you know, we still want our cousins in America to feel Irish.
Absolutely.
And therefore it's not so big a leap to think, well, the Polish person who has come here, of course they're entitled to feel Polish and Irish. We're not threatened by it, you know. We don't feel that we have to do the Muhammad Ali thing of saying, oh, you're really Irish, you know.
Or you're messing around.
Yeah, you know, that actually our sense of confidence is rooted in this idea that actually you don't lose it. Because it was all about, for so much of my lifetime, was if you don't stamp on it, if you don't keep it down, it'll go crazy and it'll go somehow. You know, that the Catholic repression, all of that, wasn't about confidence. Of course, it was about the exact opposite.
Yeah, it was insecurity about and fragility and terror.
There's so little here that you know, if we don't have this very rigid idea of what it is to be Irish, then we won't be Irish at all. And actually, the irony is I think we're much more Irish now than we were when I was born, because it's more honest, it's more open. We know who we are to a much greater extent. I chose this title, you know, we don't know ourselves. I didn't realize it doesn't work anywhere else. Like, the book came out in America, and it was don't worry about America. Nobody realizes what that title. But you know, in Ireland,
you wouldn't know yourself.
Oh, we don't know. We got a new lawnmower. We don't know ourselves. You know, it's like, I mean, it's like, you know. So it's it's meant to be the sort of pun, you know, of both of... And actually, we don't know ourselves in that sense. I mean, I did a thing with Roy Foster, the historian, and he reminded me he'd written a book in the 90s which listed the boosters and the begrudgers of Celtic Tiger Ireland. He was all in favour of... He was a booster. But I was listed as number one on the begrudgers, you know. So I'm a sort of a serial begrudger. But I don't begrudge any of this bigger change, you know. I think we can actually really be very proud of it and think, you know, actually, overall...
Oh, yeah.
We managed it, you know. But the other side of it was this, we don't know ourselves. I mean, that actually coming... Getting rid of that compartmentalization, that ability to not know what we know, you know, I think maybe we're getting closer to being able to know what we know.
I just love it. It's the image of the new lawnmower. And not, we don't know ourselves. Fintan O'Toole, ladies and gentlemen.
Now, while I have you, it's the summer. You've got a choice. You can sit in your Swiss, hang out, do nothing, have a few pints, take it handy. Or you can use the summer to learn economics with me on Patreon. We have two courses, the courses that I give in Trinity, macroeconomic courses, cycles, booms, busts, history, the history of money, all sorts of good stuff, right? We've got the notes, we've got the reading list, we've got everything. We'll take you through it. A very fine way, if you're going out for a stroll, just put the headphones in and listen and learn economics with me. That's economics with me, patreon.com/David McWilliams.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.